Item number 27, Mr. Briggs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am looking forward to the discussion on this item, and what we're going to do is I'm going to take a couple minutes to kind of set the stage, and then I'll turn it over to Michael Thomas to talk about some more specifics. This is a part of an ongoing discussion we've had on the bigger picture of water quality considerations, so I wanted to remind you a little bit of how we got here. We have long understood the value of riparian corridor protection. It's almost impossible to have good water quality and a healthy fish habitat if the creek's vegetation and the canopy is severely compromised. And we've worked over the years with various agencies and groups to improve and protect riparian corridors. You just heard in the last item about doing some vegetation of drainage ways. Another example that is more classic, I guess, is our work with over the years with San Luis Obispo Creek, with both the City of San Luis Obispo and the San Luis Obispo Land Conservancy on specific reaches of the creek to improve its canopy and its vegetated area. At last year's off-site meeting, we proposed a new initiative to accelerate and expand the riparian corridor protection and improvements on a permanent basis. We also scheduled a discussion on how low-impact development and permeable surfaces can be a big benefit as far as water quality, and that was a presentation, you'll recall, that we had from Owen Dell at our meeting in Santa Barbara in October. In conjunction with that, after last year's Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting, when Chairman Young and I had hours and hours of opportunity to talk on the way back from the meeting as we were carpooling.
You mean you were a captive audience?
Yes, I was. It was a great opportunity to talk about something that we don't talk about when we're dealing with individual permitting issues at meetings, and that's kind of the point of this whole item. And we one of the ideas that actually came up at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting and was really kind of an outgrowth of this whole concept that springs from the California Performance Review about, you know, what are these regional boards really doing and are we really being effective? And one of the concepts is that the regional boards can get bogged down in the detailed permitting issues, that is the board themselves, and spend little time on overarching policy issues or water quality planning. And they referred to basin planning, for example. Now, while the California Performance Review, at least in part, recommends almost complete delegation of permitting to executive officers with the idea that the board members focus on policy, and we don't totally agree with that, but Chair Young and I did agree that we needed to continue and expand on this idea of a bigger picture policy level discussion with the board. And that is build on the off-site meeting that we had where the board agreed with our recommendation that Michael Thomas presented regarding riparian corridor or riparian corridor initiative and the low-impact development or more permeable surfaces discussion we had in October. So at our next meeting in December, we had a multitude of water quality issues listed that are kind of outside the mainstream of our regulatory responsibilities. And I recommended at the conclusion of that December meeting that we focus on three areas that are closely related, which coupled with our significant efforts and changes in the vast number of acres of agricultural land that we have in the region, which was right in line with the last item we were talking about, that we could make a huge difference in terms of ultimate water quality, the ultimate water quality picture in our region. Those three connected issues that we agreed to focus on at the December meeting were riparian corridors, which we talked about at the off-site meeting, enhanced stormwater management, kind of going beyond the regulatory requirements of the stormwater program, and then the idea of low-impact development. So those were the three areas that we agreed to concentrate on, and they are linked. So I want to remind you, and actually our council has reminded me, that we have statutory responsibilities to be regulators, to issue effective permits, to enforce them, to order and oversee groundwater cleanups, and those are absolutely high priority issues. we have to continue to execute those programs well to have a healthy region. So we're not saying, you know, we're ignoring that responsibility and that need. But we are talking about raising our sights above the individual program details and not just seeing what's staring back at us, but actually defining that vision. What should we see in a couple of decades and beyond? And an important point when others have brought this up, for example, at that Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting when they talked about the board should be planning, an important point that is, I think, missed is that that's an incomplete idea. It's kind of vision impaired. That is, planning by itself really does nothing. We have to effectuate plans. And I think that's very much in line with what the board was just talking about in the last item, making sure that we're being effective with these plans. And it's what you're talking about yesterday when you had concerns about the supplemental environmental projects, for example, with the PISMO supplemental funds. So that's right in line with what I'm talking about here, that planning is not enough. We have to have our sights set on implementation. And that translates into on-the-ground improvements for water quality improvements and for fisheries improvements. So what changes do we want to make? We need to bring that picture of how we want to change the region into focus. We need to define that vision of what we're calling a conservation ethic. And so with that as an introduction and a backdrop, I will turn it over to a man who is not vision impaired, Michael Thomas.
Thanks, Roger. This is an unusual item in that we're talking about the... I can't see Mr. Daniels here past the camera. It is an unusual item in that we're looking at the bigger picture here. You know, it's like almost a philosophical discussion, at least initially, the first part of this. But we do want to... We understand that it is, and we want to bring it to the board and put it out there and have the board give us some direction on this. We think it's one of the most important items that we can bring to the board. The question, as Roger said, is that we are asking ourselves is, what will the Central Coast region look like in 20 or 30 years? What will it physically look like? And that's what we are going to leave behind. The Central Coast region will be in some physical condition 20 or 30 years from now, and we will be largely responsible for it. It can be in very good condition or it can be in lousy condition. In either case, we're going to be responsible for it. The regional board and the state board mission is to protect beneficial uses for future generations. And we're asking this question, are we doing this? I put this land use map up here because it's important to think about our region in physical terms and what's going on in our region and what the physical forces are that are shaping our region. We really have two choices. We can physically protect resources for future generations, and we think that requires a vision and a proactive approach, or we can preside over the demise of resources, and that would be a passive and reactive approach. I know I've been to many talks over the years where a presenter will say something like, we've lost 90% of our wetlands in California over the past 100 years. And I've often wondered about that statement. You know, how can we so casually say it? If there are so many people that are so concerned about that physical resource, why is it that it's gone? And I think it's because of the second choice. It's presiding over the demise of resources and taking a passive and reactive approach. A successful approach would look something like this, where we start with the assessment here and go to planning. Assess and prioritize, then go to planning, and then make actual physical changes out in the real world. And then we measure and verify those physical changes, those improvements, and we bring that back to the board, to ourselves, and to the public. We inform based on that information that we collect. We actually inform that we are, in fact, doing these things. And then we keep going through the cycle. When we get to this point, we should have fixed some things. We should have made some improvement and brought about some change. And that means that we would begin assessing and prioritizing again, planning, and going through this process again. what I think happens in many situations and with many organizations is that we truncate this process, and we follow a path of an easier path, which would be to do the assessment prioritization planning, and then we get into this process where we're listing issues, we're raising the alarm about problems that exist, we're writing reports and having meetings, and we're focusing on programs and prioritizing our programs. That's something that we've done here. We put a lot of energy into prioritizing our programs on a regular basis. And much of that is driven by EPA and state board requirements, where we get direction from external directions. Sometimes it's political. And what happens are these, the more important processes, get truncated. The irony is that if we were to do these things really well, we would work ourselves out of a job. It's a paradox, but I think that if we accept that paradox, we're less likely to be here in this situation, and more likely to be actually making improvements. And since this staff report came out, a lot of people that work here at the office, a lot of staff here, have given me some pretty good input on it. Some of it is some good constructive criticism that of ways to improve it, improve the staff report, and improve the notion of going after a vision and describing it. Some folks have said that it doesn't go far enough. But one thing that is common is that we have a lot of people working here who are super dedicated to what they do, and they really want to make that physical reality occur, and they want to participate in the process, which I think is really neat. So for the June board meeting, what we're thinking about is that we would bring back to the board some description of the future physical condition that we want to create for the Central Coast region, and at the very least, a discussion of how we would use the tools available to us to create that. And that includes how we measure it in the real world, and bring that back to the board. In the meantime, what's going to happen is we're going to have a lot of internal meetings to talk about this with the board staff. And like I said before, there are a lot of people here that are interested in it and want to work on it, and we're going to capitalize on that to the maximum extent possible. Now I'm going to talk about the conservation program, the conservation ethic. I've called it a conservation program. I called it a conservation program back in June when we first talked about it and in the staff report, and it's kind of bothering me that I'm to use that word program, because we've already got so many programs, and I think it gives the idea that we're going to go out and hire staff and write some plans or reports and just continue on with the idea of that stigma that programs have associated with it. So I like to think of this as the anti-program. It's really an ethic that we are going to incorporate into what we already do. We're going to change the way we do business. We've already said that we want to focus on two main issues, and those are agriculture, ag land management practices, and urbanization. And obviously, these are huge issues in our region. Agriculture is occurring on millions of acres. As mentioned in the staff report, grazing is done on 3.2 million acres of this region. Irrigated agriculture is occurring on about 430,000 acres. So that activity alone dictates the condition of beneficial uses on the majority of terra firma in this region. Urbanization is another huge issue for our region. The Pew Oceans Commission's report discusses what's going to happen in the next 20 or 30 years, which is a national migration of people to the seaboards. It's already been occurring over the past decade, and they expect it to increase significantly. We'll also have general population increase in California. The state of California predicts that our population will go from 36 million, what it is today, to 50 million by the year 20 to 2025. And we have to ask ourselves, are we planning for that population increase? It's as if the entire state of New York would be moving to California. And the problem is, with urbanization, it is the increased concentration of people, the pollutants that they generate, and the impervious surfaces that deliver those pollutants to our surface waters. So we want to recognize this and plan for it. the main elements of the conservation ethic would be to create a managed account with a community foundation. And I've been talking to a couple of different foundations about this, and I'm finding that they are very flexible and very willing to help us in this regard. They can provide a variety of services. We want to, ideally, we would have one account. If we were to do it locally, we could use the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation. And the idea of having one account is that we have one statement where most or all of the regional board's funds would be located in this account. We would get one quarterly statement that could go to the board on a quarterly basis, and you could see how much we have and where it is being spent and how it is being managed. Right now we have funds spread out in several different places, and it's much more difficult to manage in that way. We also want to establish criteria for this account, which includes obviously how those funds could be spent, the type of projects that could be done. Mainly we want to implement best management practices, as Roger said, enhanced best management practices for stormwater, promote low-impact development projects, do best management practices on agricultural lands, and protect critical habitat. And as I mentioned in the staff report, we're defining critical habitat as that habitat that is critical for the protection of water quality, such as riparian corridors, wetlands, and their buffer zones. And also a major part of this, a major element, would be leverage. And I've been talking to conservation organizations. Just two days ago, I was talking to the San Luis Obispo County Land Conservancy. They're very excited about this idea. One of the things we may need to set up this account is a list of projects, sort of a library of projects, that would be ready to go. They would meet the criteria, and they could be funded. They have milestones and products, goals established with them already. And Mr. Stark with the Land Conservancy said they already have that type of list available, that library of projects. And I've also been talking to the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation. They are the environmental funding arm of the Packard Foundation, and with Nature Conservancy staff. And with the Legacy Fund Foundation people, what I've been talking about is this idea of conservation that's done on a large scale, like the Hearst Ranch, where we spent, as a community, we spent $95 million to preserve 82,000 acres of land. And what I'm suggesting to these larger organizations with access to funds of that scale is that we might be able to do a much better job than setting aside these museum pieces. And I'm trying to get the same concept across to these folks, is what do we want to leave behind? What do we want the Central Coast to look like in 20 years? Do we want urban sprawl, a Central Coast characterized by urban sprawl with these museum pieces dotted around in it? And they're listening. They're interested in the idea. And what I'm suggesting is that we can combine the board's regulatory authority with these larger scale conservation efforts to help create this future condition. So I have their attention, and they are interested.
How would you use our regulatory authority to do that?
Well, if we could use funds, such as the regional board funds, and get matching funds from other organizations, like these conservation organizations, we would use them in two basic ways. One would be to create low-impact development projects. That right now, we can't, as far as I know, out-and-out require those from municipalities, although I think it is going in that direction. But if we could set up these demonstrations, like whole projects, whole neighborhoods that are built using the latest low-impact development standards, we would then have an example. And that example would drive change. We could point to that example and say, this is what we expect of the other municipalities, and I think regulation would follow. Same thing with our agricultural practices.
And where's our money coming from?
The regional board's money? From settlements and SEP-type projects, enforcement actions. That's where the board's money would come from, and matching funds from other organizations.
Okay.
So we still have to keep up a certain level of reactive activity in order to fund our proactive activity.
We have to keep doing our job, our statutory job, yes. This is a the diagram that's it's a little bit different than the staff report, but it just lays out the different parts, the regional board, the community foundation, and staff, and our roles. I won't repeat it. It is in the staff report. If the board has questions or wants to comment on it, we can discuss it. So what are we doing now to incorporate this conservation ethic into what we do? We're actually doing quite a few things. Something I've talked to Howard Kolb about just recently is the 401 certification program. This is what I call a sleeper program. It's probably one of the most powerful programs that the board oversees. I have 410, it should be 401 certification program. And Howard Kolb is working on a countywide 401 certification permit for the county of Santa Cruz right now. And we were talking about doing that here in San Luis Obispo and leveraging that regulatory program with other organizations. If we did it here, we could leverage it with a non-regulatory entity such as the Land Conservancy of Slo County, where the Land Conservancy is doing a substantial amount of work, for example, on San Luis Obispo Creek. We've been working with them for years on it. We think we could leverage those efforts by any project that is proposed to be done in a creek, that it has to be done in coordination with a larger overall effort to protect that creek or a reach of that creek. So that would be a way to leverage our efforts. We're having discussions with Salinas and the city of Salinas and the city of Santa Maria on low-impact development projects and how we would actually bring this about. And what we're finding there is that it is going to take education and outreach, something that we were just talking about in the previous item. And I wish it didn't. I wish that we could go in and say, you will build this project, it will meet these design standards, and you'll start today. But when I try to do that, people bring me back to reality and say there are other people involved in these things with other ideas. So I realize we have to go through the education and outreach process, and we're talking about how to do that right now and where we could get funds to make that happen. And that would include education and outreach on the design standards, on ordinances, and on the projects themselves. And we have some...
Pardon? Just a question. The education portion of this is going to be directed to whom?
To the cities, to the staff, and even city councilmen, the people that would be the decision makers in that process.
Good, that's what I was thinking of. If you don't get to the decision makers, the planners, and even some of the people that a good deal of benefit would be to reach out to some of the building industry.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get to some of the sleazebag quick buck artists, but the ones that are located and intend to be part of the community may profit from it. But this is going to be a political process.
Yes, I agree. It won't be easy. We're literally talking about changing, similar to the agricultural community. We're talking about a cultural and social change, and we realize that. Another discussion I've been having just recently with Chris Rose, who works for the regional board in the TMDL program. We're talking about a TMDL he's working on for Choro Creek and introducing this idea of riparian corridor restoration for an entire reach of Choro Creek as part of a TMDL order. And we're just at the discussion stage, but that's how we're changing. We're changing the way we think about these things. I already mentioned the Land Conservancy and the Library of Projects and the discussion with the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation and other conservation organizations. That is ongoing. I also wanted to mention that as far as incorporating the conservation ethic and how it can be done in ways that we had never thought before, this is what we did with our power plant permits. And when we first introduced the idea years ago about conserving land north of Diablo Canyon and setting up the mitigation fund at Elkhorn Slough, the first reaction from all the people involved were, you can't do this, it's not legal. It's against policies or it's against procedures or it's just not the way we've done things in the past. But here we are. You know, we've made some pretty significant progress on those projects, and those are NPDES permits. And conservation is not normally associated with an NPDES permit, but we did it. So to conclude, regarding the vision, we'd like to get direction from the board to proceed with this and come back to the board in June. We're hoping to have a meeting at the Elkhorn Slough Visitor Center, and we would like to first present the board with the progress that has been made in the Elkhorn Slough area as a result of the $7 million fund that the board designated to be managed by the Elkhorn Slough Foundation. We'd like to show you kind of before and after what has happened there. They've conserved, they've purchased and are restoring and protecting 2,000 acres since the board made that decision. They've established a 9-mile-long buffer zone up Carneros Creek and purchased, I think, all of the land, or almost all of the land around the Morro Coho Slough, and are working on restoring 180 acres of wetlands in the Morro Coho Slough. So they're doing a lot of good work there, and we'd like to show that to the board and actually take you out on a field trip and show you that. Then we would come back and talk about the future condition of the regional board, the Central Coast, and how we would achieve that. We also need internal buy-in. It's critical that staff of the regional board feel like they're a part of this process and that they not only contribute to it, but help drive it and create it. And as I mentioned, staff would define the condition, that future condition, and a roadmap for getting there. Regarding the conservation ethic, we're working on the criteria for that account, the library of projects, and a memorandum of agreement with the foundation, and I'm aiming towards the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation at this time. And as I mentioned, we talked to a couple of foundations. Another is the Santa Barbara County Foundation.
Wouldn't that agency have difficulty doing things region-wide? Because, I mean, there is even a political angle, because in each county there's similar kinds of groups, and they'd feel beset upon if the SLO group was coming in and doing projects in their area. Wouldn't it be better to get some kind of agency that's more region-wide rather than county-wide?
We could look. I don't know of a financial foundation that matches our region, the Central Coast.
Yeah, I don't know either.
But we could look. No, I'm not aware of any. In talking to the two community foundations, San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara, they have not indicated to me any problem at all working across county lines. The Santa Barbara Foundation said that it would be absolutely no problem.
Well, you haven't talked to Santa Cruz yet, have you?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. There could, these organizations are financial management organizations, and I'm sure they would like to manage these funds. That's what they do.
Yeah.
So they would prefer that we, each one would prefer that we use them. And we were talking to the Santa Barbara Community Foundation because they're the biggest and most successful, one of the biggest and most successful in the United States.
One is, as well, each one knows their area. So I'm not sure how much the San Luis Obispo Foundation knows about what's going on in Monterey and which lands are important, what are the hot spots, and who to talk to acquire the land, and all those, and who in the county commission to talk to make sure that, blah, 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 blah. So,
well, I would think of the community foundation as similar to the way you would think of as a bank. A bank is not necessarily involved in the project. Your bank is not necessarily involved in the projects that you do. They're just your bank. Mm-hmm. Now, you could have the San Luis Obispo County Community Foundation, but we would definitely have other organizations in these other areas. You would have conservation organizations or the Farm Bureau or whatever organization you're working with up in Monterey, and one in Santa Cruz, and one in San Luis Obispo, and one in Santa Barbara. This organization would simply direct funds to those other organizations as directed by the executive officer. So they would not play a role in the implementation of the project in that area. The other organization would do that. We would simply direct funds to that other organization.
That makes sense.
So regarding the conservation ethic, we have a lot of brainstorming to do between now and June, as well as with the vision, and we're going to bring an update back to the board. We'll keep bringing updates back to the board on both of these things, but we've made a commitment to do that with this conservation ethic idea on a every other board meeting basis, I believe. So with that, we'll open it up to discussion.
Okay. Any questions? Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank you for doing this, and I'd also like to thank everyone here, because I've been interesting as you've been talking, seeing the staff members come in and in and in. And so I'd like to applaud all of you, your interest in this, and you know, the concern you have for, I think, you know, the future we're talking about here. So I think that's great to see.
They're really just concerned about how their job descriptions are going to change. Don't get so excited, Bruce.
Well, in fact, that's my first question, is about how do we corral our resources, which is kind of people and hours in the day, so that we can actually try and accomplish some of these things? Because this isn't going to happen, you know, automatically and for free. Right. So how do we save away a little bit of stuff so we can do this in addition to, you know, the, as was mentioned before, our reactive work jobs?
I think we, all of us, are going to be talking about this a lot in the next few months. Mm-hmm. And by setting this June date to bring a report back to the board, I like that because it sets a timeline on it, you know, a pretty short timeline. We're forced to produce something in that timeline. But I think what's going to happen is we're going to talk about or figure out how to change the way we work in our programs. Not that we're going to create new positions or go off and do other work. It's change the work that we're doing and focus it differently. Coordinate it better and focus it so that it produces this future condition instead of having different units, different people working on different projects going in their own directions. I hope that we can come together more, work together to and aim our programs, bend them, even break them if necessary, so that they are pointed towards this future condition. Now, I'll use because it's my own experience, the power plant projects using those NPDES permits, it was really difficult. You know, there was a lot of resistance to doing anything other than traditional NPDES regulatory work with that permit. And what we ended up doing was far different, and now that has set a precedent for how those permits are handled elsewhere in the country. So it can be done, and I hope that's what we end up doing.
One of the things I think that's important to think about, I mean, as you say, you know, the world is changing, and I think it's important for us to have the right goals. You know, if after 10 years and we come back and we had these lofty goals and we didn't get them, you know, for example, in the face of growth, sometimes simply maintaining the current thing is a great success. You know, simply keeping things from going to hell in a handbasket mm-hmm. is sometimes a very difficult piece of work. And mm-hmm. so I think it's important for us to know so where things might otherwise go so we can have realistic goals. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of us would like to say, you know, we will reduce pollution by 50%, but if you have that kind of a goal plus, you know, the growth going like that, you know, that's quite a spread, and mm-hmm. maybe that goal is just not achievable. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to have realistic expectations.
Yeah, I agree, and I'm getting input from all these folks right along those lines. Mm-hmm. So I think we're lucky. I think the board is lucky that you have people that are so dedicated to what they want to do and very good at what they do.
Yeah.
And thinking about these very same things, the limitations, what's possible, and how to get there.
I'm appreciative of it every time I sit up here. One of the things that I've seen for this kind of a thing where you're sort of trying to break the mold and go off in new directions, and it was kind of led this way with some of the discussions you've mentioned you've been having, is to sit down and have a vision summit of get all the players together, you know, the Packard Foundations and some of those together, and you know, get together and think about, you know, where should we all be going, where do we all want to go, what's possible to do, and what would have to change to make these things happen, because it sounds like, you know, with what you're thinking about, it's not just going to be us that's going to make this happen. It's going to be right. us with quite a cooperative relationship with, you know, lots of other entities.
Right.
To get them to buy in, you just don't write a document and send it to them and get that to happen.
Right.
You need to make them be a partner in that process rather than just simply an adjunct to the process.
Yep. We have, you know, I can give you some examples of that. When we were talking about last year, when we were talking about possibly using the Diablo Canyon mitigation funds for marine reserves, we went to the Resources Legacy Fund people and said, you guys are already working in this direction and providing money to the state. would you be willing to put some matching funds on the table if the regional board wanted to go in this direction? And they initially said, yeah, we could maybe think about $50,000. We then had a whole series of discussions with them, and they ended up agreeing to put $2.5 million on the table and to augment that mitigation fund. And you know, we did the same thing in the Elkhorn Sioux with the $7 million fund. So I totally agree, and I think it would be great if we can put something together for June or even beyond June that the board is happy with and staff here feel comfortable with and they buy into and actually want to devote a good chunk of their careers to doing this, that we can then go out and meet with these other people or bring them here, the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation people, Nature Conservancy, other organizations like these local land conservancy organizations, bring them here into this room and say, here's what we want to produce or we want to create in the future and we need your help to do it and this is how we see it unfolding. I think they would be very interested in doing it.
Well, I'm thinking about even rather than presenting them our vision, let's sit down and talk about, like you've done here, the problem and say, let's work together to produce a vision. Because if they have bought into the vision versus them being given a vision, then they're much more willing to help make it happen because it's their vision as well as our vision.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Give them the vision. It's shorter.
The final thing is I like the idea of going and seeing the things at the Elkhorn Slough you mentioned, but I have actually a problem with that being kind of a big locale to start this out on because, you know, the staff who I think are going to be key to this won't all be able to come to the Elkhorn Slough site.
Yeah, so we talked about that.
So I would much rather have, you know, big discussions and going over what you're presenting here because I think that's going to allow, you know, the staff to participate, and I think that's key.
Along those lines, actually, Michael and I talked about that, and of course, the way we've handled the offsite, even when we're here locally, which is where we've always been for the offsite meeting, is it's been with the board and senior staff, as opposed to opening it up to the entire staff. Not that we're elitists about that, but I think if you get too big of a group, it's difficult to have a interactive discussion. It becomes more of a board meeting. So we wanted to. And it's up to the board, but the idea with the offsite was to have more of a chance to actually have a discussion as a group as opposed to the board meeting setting that we have now. And maybe the answer is to do both and have kind of the traditional offsite format, which is a smaller group, but then have other opportunities like this that are here where more staff can attend and not only listen, but hopefully participate as well.
Well, another idea is we could have it in the Elkhorn Slough locale and just simply have a phone connection here so that staff who want to listen in on the discussions could listen in and hear what we're thinking about.
True.
Michael, my only comment would be is I'm very happy to see that we're doing something proactive instead of reactive, and government historically reacts to problems. And that's what we do mainly here is that we react to a problem or a spill or a discharge or whatever. And it's kind of nice to hear something positive looking in the future to be proactive and try to curb some of those things before they actually happen. And you're absolutely correct with just part of the staff that we have here. You have a tremendous amount of brain power, a lot of gray mass out there, and especially with the young people that have just been hired. They'll have new ideas, more energy. And, you know, all their eyes are focused on you because you're sitting there. And there, I hope all that energy will be focused into putting this plan to be successful. And as you heard me say before, I don't like just doing plans and putting them on shelves. If we can't implement those plans, then they're really not worth a whole lot.
I agree.
I mean, you could paper walls with plans. Nothing's ever been done. But if we can start putting things in motion, it takes time. But I think it's critical, as Bruce mentioned, that we try to involve as many of the staff in putting this together. because if we don't have the total staff buying into this, it isn't going to work. Because they all have to buy into it, as well as the board. Now, we can set direction, but if don't want to do it, or there's something else that's going on, put it on the back shelf, nothing ever gets done. But I applaud you, and I applaud Roger and the rest of the folks that are sitting out there for these type of ideas, and I'm very happy.
Is the state board involved in this in any way?
Heavens, no.
Let's keep it a secret.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Was my
he's gone.
On
okay.
I said?
I'm pretty excited about this direction, you know, myself. And what I would like to see happen is that as you start to formulate this ethic, that we try to incorporate everything that we can from all staff that want to have input into this. I mean, I know you mentioned when you showed that flow diagram that you're all already getting comments on that. And I think that's great. I would like to see us try to incorporate everything that we can. You know, there may be some staff comments that I would not want to see kind of deleted before the board can maybe take a look at it, kind of get a feel, and, you know, we'll have that kind of a sorting mechanism going out at that level. Because and this goes for public comment, too. I mean, the public should know that they should be involved in this and contributing to how we form the ethic that we're going to follow. And I think collectively that we can come up with something that we all buy into. And if we don't consider some components of it, at least, you know, people will feel that, you know, those components have been considered and discussed and for whatever reason may not have been included. But I think that's the way to get a real strong ethic put together. And I agree, we got a lot of brain power. You know, it would really be neat to see what we could unleash collectively. Mm-hmm. And put together and just kind of decide how do we want things to look in so many years and how can we accomplish that and how can we go through each of the functions we currently do. You know, I think of the TMDL program and my kind of playful jabs with Lisa from time to time about how we can do things, you know, with, you know, the San Lorenzo River or whatever else we're dealing with. How do we kind of my frustration, and let's get into implementation already. And I like your thoughts about looking at not just TMDL, but the 401 program, and anything else that staff is aware of that we can start tweaking, that will start to, you know, just fold in the ethic with what we're doing. You know, I think that's it's great. I'd also like to kind of know how we can flex our regulatory power, you know, Lori, in a way that we are doing more proactive restoration work. And that comment follows, you know, what we heard at the WQCC, I think from, it was either Phil or Craig, about their thought that we had enough regulatory authority to do restoration. Remember there was a case that I emailed to Roger or to you that I think Phil was citing for that proposition. I'm not quite sure what he was getting at with it. I think it was a police power case, but and it may have been the wrong site. But they seem to think that we can do more restoration, and I think that that really is the key, and that's what Russ is saying, that we need to be more proactive. So, you know, I'd like to know what the limits are in terms of us getting into restoration, and can we develop a TMDL and actually
have some requirements that some BMPs be specific ones implemented that we want to see, even on, you know, pilot scale projects. You had Salinas and Santa Maria up there.
Yes.
I just want to throw this out. The city of Santa Barbara, I mean, has money. And in fact, they get $2 million a year in Measure B funds from 2% of the hotel tax. And this comes in every year. And that would be an opportunity if there was something specific that the board and the staff wanted to see implemented, that we might have a good shot with the city of Santa Barbara in putting up some money and getting them to put up some of their own money to do something that we would like to see demonstrated, and it would benefit, you know, the region. But they might be very agreeable to that, especially if they were approached by the board.
Okay.
So
we'll
I'm not quite, maybe, I don't know why Salinas and Santa Maria were put up there. Was it more because they need some help in this
areas
area?
Areas of major growth.
Right, okay.
Well, let me just expand on why Salinas, and I think I brought it out at the Salinas meeting, that Salinas is in the process of putting an application to LAFCA to annex a great amount of land, agricultural land, to build 14,000 houses. And that's a lot of houses. And if we can be ahead of that and get them to implement some of our suggestions into their developers' plans, that would be a tremendous asset that we could measure. And a demonstration project, definitely. And that isn't going to be easy. I can tell you that now, because developers will fight you right on down to the last drop of anything. Because I've been there, done
and
that.
Municipal staffs also.
They
want to keep doing things the way they've done it. My grandfather did it. My great-great-great-grandfather did it.
Well, people are resistant to change, but I think if you can show the way to staff that there's a better way of doing it, a lot of times they'll buy in, but the developers are looking at cost. And I think that we would have to prove to them this is beneficial to them and probably cost-effective to them.
Agreed.
But I think that's why, and I don't know about Santa Maria, but I know Santa Maria is a large growth area mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you right on our immediate horizon that Salinas is planning on doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So
one other thing I'd like to throw out as a consideration. We clearly are talking about some great ideas here, some great vision. But in doing our planning, I think we also need to think about doing things stepwise. If we sit around here planning for the ultimate great future, we'll end up with the scenario of never doing anything. And we need to think about what can we do today? What can I do next month? What can we do next year? And some things we may not get to until next decade, and some of us may not be on the board anymore, but hopefully if we set in motion this train to the future, it'll end up going there.
When you pointed to me, Bruce, and said, don't do anything, does that mean?
You brought up the notion of plans sitting on the shelf and never getting
a plan. I thought you were meaning I didn't go.
No.
I think once we start to develop these three items, the riparian buffer zone, the low-impact development, innovative stormwater management, I think once we start to flesh that out more.
Okay. Yeah, but even those, I mean, we may have the great vision for what we think of low-impact development, but maybe we can't do it all this time. So let's do what we can. Let's work with the developers that we can, work with the city staffs that we can, and get things better.
Well, all that we can do is to start to set up some examples.
Right.
And that will be the domino effect, hopefully.
Well, demonstration projects are
right.
going to be extremely
a big
important.
Thing. But then again, I'd like to know what we can do regulatory power-wise to affect how land is used. And how, you know, I'd like to know, from your perspective, Lori, how can we be creative in this area and start to push the envelope a little bit?
Well, that would give Lori enough time between now and June and Michael to get together, and they could put all this together and start formulating some of these things.
I mean, what can we do with the basin plan that, you know, would give us that that cover or anything else? So, and then besides the TMDL program and the 401 cert, whatever else is out there.
Oh, we're going to look at everything.
I mean, you guys know. We don't, but you know. Mm-hmm. What can we start tweaking to bring about, you know, those end results? So any other comments?
Can we apply for some of those PG&E funds that are left for this project?
I think you can.
Okay.
There might be a conflict of interest here.
Yes, Gary.
Yeah. One thing that I was really impressed about, I really like this idea, but one thing I was really impressed about when I first came on the board, there was a statement, sort of a mission statement or something, I can't even remember what it was, about how our job was to protect and enhance water quality. And I was really excited about the enhancement part, but it seems like all we have time for is, you know, trying to maintain the status quo. And sounds like this is sort of heading in that direction a little more. So I think that's pretty exciting. And I think that enhancement line in the mission statement or whatever it is certainly gives us a lot of cover to start moving in this direction, at least exploring it.
So. Okay.
Full speed ahead.
All right.
I just want to mention one other thing that I meant to mention. Is that when we were talking to Roger about this, setting up this conservation ethic and bringing the board's funds as they are accumulated in the future from settlements and enforcement actions, bringing them together in one account with criteria, that it would accomplish two main things, that those are physical changes in the real world, that's what we want to point them to, that we come back and inform the board that we are actually doing these things, and two, it gives staff an opportunity to work on projects that they think are important. Like they can say, I want to go out and restore this chunk of the creek and I want to work with these people on it, or I want to implement a low impact development project over here and I want to work with these, the best experts in the country on it. So it provides them with an opportunity to dream up something and go after it. And then we don't have that opportunity here, you know, or most government agencies, and we can create that with this. So.
Good.
Just wanted to add that.
Okay. We're definitely going to have staff to go out and find lots of discharges and accumulate lots of money so we can do all this, right?
Well, Gary actually reminded me of a notion that could be proactive enforcement, where we actually issue complaints before the violations occur, be on top of things. That might be. I don't know, check into that, Lori, will you? Bruce mentioned going stepwise I guess I'll have to deal with a mundane detail after the lofty discussion, and that is this June meeting we're talking about. We kicked around a couple different ideas. Michael's idea was that it would be beneficial for the board to be able to see in person, in the field, some of the benefits from some of the things that we have been able to leverage through the Elkhorn Slough Foundation. And you know, there's an upside and downside. It takes more time. It's a way in terms of more of the staff. An alternative is to have pictures of those things. It may not be as effective as being there in person in the field, but that is an alternative if the board would prefer to do that. So I thought I'd throw that out as an option, but we would like to know what your preference is today so that we can make plans accordingly as far as that June offsite meeting. And I think it's really up to you as far as which you'd rather do.
I imagine that we could find projects here to go and visit. You know, I'm sure that there are a few great projects right here in San Luis Obispo, in the San Luis Obispo area. So we could still have the same presentation with the Elkhorn Slough Foundation folks. If we wanted to do that, we could have it here and then maybe work out a field trip in this area. That's something the board wanted to do.
Bruce,
my preference is whatever you think is best.
Excuse me, but Lori Okun just suggested something that might be a a good idea, which is, since we're going to be in Watsonville in May, maybe have a field trip for those board members who are available prior to that board meeting, because Watsonville is a stone's throw from Elkhorn Slough, and then have the off-site here.
Have the off-site on-site?
Not necessarily here in the building.
Oh.
We could go over to the airport.
I like the idea of having the whole staff involved in part of that, though. And is there some reason we have to be off out of this building?
Nope.
Offsite. Okay. Because what I was thinking, it might be nice to do our regular offsite thing, but maybe have it here and have the department heads, like we have at the offsite,
mm-hmm.
do a panel with them and the board, and maybe have the other folks as observers for part of it, and then sort of throw it open to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because that way we could get the sort of intimate dialogue, and at the same time have everyone else involved. I don't know.
That'd be fine.
I'm just throwing that out. And then we could go to the beach.
So does the idea of trying to work in the field portion for those, again, the board members who are available in conjunction with the May meeting, does that sound good since
mm-hmm.
we'll all be in Watsonville anyway?
That's fine.
That's good.
And okay. Then June we'll be here. And you guys can put together a more expanded off-site, on-site meeting.
Yes, off-on. Okay.
With more staff involved.
All right. Good.
Let's see. Now, we're not done with this agenda item, I take it?
We're done?
Okay. The plastics. Can we have a little discussion about that?
Sure.
Okay, because I would like to see us doing something more with that. And as I read through the staff report, I got the sense that maybe because we couldn't confirm the numbers on the amount of or the poundage of the plastics versus the plankton, that, you know, it seemed to be a stumbling block to us maybe doing more in our effort to maybe contain plastic, or also mixed in with that was we don't see much plastic in the region, and therefore it's not something we should be addressing. So
I don't think that's the idea.
Okay.
I think what you're referring to was we were trying to, instead of seeing a video and accepting it as gospel.
Okay.
Actually, somebody on staff said, "Gee, we probably ought to see if that's really verifiable in terms of the facts." I mean, obviously, right. We know that there are plenty of plastic products that end up in the waterways, but in terms of the some of the statements that were made as far as things like PCB accumulation and replacing plankton and stuff like that, or being confused by critters for plankton, the suggestion was maybe we should check that out. So that was the reason for actually Peter checking that out. And so we provided the information that Peter was able to find, which I don't think it contradicts the basic idea.
Okay.
And so that, you know, the idea is not to say, oh, well, never mind, plastics aren't a problem in our region.
Mm-hmm.
It was just to see, get some other opinions in terms of the validity of the statements in the video. And I think they were largely supported.
Okay.
And it, I don't think it in any way negates the need to do everything that we can. We talked on a couple levels. You know, there's the idea of the most effective thing to do would be source control, and that's definitely something that goes above and beyond what we do as regulators of water quality. That would probably be the most effective thing is to deal with the manufacture of plastics. But from the standpoint of things that are more within our realm, which is stormwater and enhanced stormwater management, if we can if through our stormwater program we can keep a lot of that litter from hitting the ground in the first place, litter including plastics, and as well as having effective capture mechanisms so that fewer of those plastics make it into surface waters, if we are successful with low-impact development so that we can reduce the runoff rates that carry that, those plastics off to the creeks and eventually to the ocean, then we can do our part. And, you know, it seems like almost an insurmountable task when you think about plastics in the ocean, but we should be doing what we can to do our part. So that's the way I see it, and I see us working through the stormwater program to try to eliminate as many of those plastics as possible from making it into our creeks and eventually, since we're a coastal region, into the ocean.
Well, tell me why we shouldn't have a flat-out prohibition on the discharge of any plastics into surface water.
Well, I think we do through the basin plan. I'm not sure I could cite it right at the moment, but I guess what you're getting at is, should we have a TMDL, should we have a basin plan prohibition in order to solve the problem? And the point I was trying to make before is I don't think that's really the most effective way to spend our time in terms of solving the problem. I think we can work through our stormwater program, and that's probably the most effective way to use our time to try to make a dent in the problem. But, you know, I don't think anyone would argue that it's legal for them to dump plastics into a waterway. So what good does it do for us to say, look, we have a new prohibition? Or like L.A. did, we adopted the TMDL, and by golly, the allowable discharge rate is zero. I'll be darned. Let's assume that.
But they can be cited for then violating that, you know, basin plan amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we don't really have that. We don't have that power here.
I think we probably do through the stormwater program. And I don't know if, Laura, you have any thoughts on that. But you're talking about discharging trash into a waterway.
Right.
And it seems to me that we would have the regulatory authority if we, you know, came across a situation where they were flagrantly violating that. Seems like we could do something about it. But I think the more insidious thing is, you know, the kids walking to school and throwing their wrappers out, and that's an ethic. You know, we're not going to go around issuing administrative civil liabilities because they violated our discharge prohibition. I think it's more gets back to this ethic of how are we treating our region.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see how adopting a prohibition really gets us anywhere, or in terms of the best use of our time. I don't see it that way, but
well,
I could be wrong.
We talked a little bit about this with the Salinas permit, and we made an addition or a change to that permit.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my question would be, or I would feel more comfortable if we had something that was more mandatory with a plastic BMP than something that was more left up to the discharger to employ.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they still have to meet the MEP standard in their permits, and when we approve the swamps, it's up to staff and the board to determine what level of preventing this trash from getting into stormwater that we can require under MEP or under any more stringent regulation that we feel is necessary in compliance with the stormwater requirement. So we can require that the BMPs be spelled out more specifically in the swamps. There's a range of BMPs that can be required to be implemented, and something like a zero trash discharge would be really difficult to do under the stormwater program because it's more than MEP, because the cost is enormous, which is the issue in the trash TMDL litigation in L.A. In terms of a basin plan prohibition, I agree that the stormwater program is the best way to address it. It's not a case like other types of discharges where there's a point source or some kind of industrial discharge. There isn't a point source other than the stormwater facilities or the MS4s that are discharging trash or plastics. And if we were to find that, it would be a Clean Water Act violation already, because you can't do that without a permit, and we wouldn't permit somebody dumping a bunch of plastic. Similarly, with the WDRs program, I mean, there may be landfills that aren't adequately controlled, but we already regulate those under Title 27. So I'm not sure what authority a prohibition would give us that we don't already have.
Okay, well, and I'm not thinking of a discharger or an entity that is intentionally dumping something. Obviously, this is an area where, you know, you drive by a, the Laguna Creek in Santa Barbara, and, you know, through the summer, it's not, it doesn't flow. You got a sand berm down at the beach. But there's trash accumulating in this thing through the year just because of neglect and no one's paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. And then you get that first flush that comes around and the big storms and boom, there's a big slug of this that goes out in the ocean. So that just seems to be falling right under the radar. And that's somewhat of what I would like to try to get at. Gary?
Yeah, there's probably a couple of reasons you might want to think about creating a regulation or a ban, and it isn't necessarily because you think it's going to be successfully enforced. You also might want to do something like that or take some sort of action similar to that to educate, to get the discussion going, to get the dialogue going, to raise people's consciousness about the issue. Certainly, the L.A. Trash TMDL, you know, whether that was, even if that had been struck down earlier on, it certainly got people talking about it and raised that as an issue. So I think we need to think a little more outside the box on how we can use some of our powers, our regulatory powers, in that sense. It doesn't necessarily have to be for the most obvious reason that the power is put there. And specifically on the plastics issue, obviously it's a much broader issue than Region 3 can take care of. So in that sense, it actually might be ideal for something a little bolder, just to raise the issue and get the dialogue going statewide.
To set the bar
exactly
at a high level.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
We should let Jennifer Bidding talk because she's going to jump out of her shoes here.
Is she going to explode?
I just thought I might be able to make you feel a little bit better about some of the things that we are working on as far as trash and stormwater management plans.
Please do.
And so I'll just throw out a couple of things.
Okay.
If I get too excited and talk too long, you can always stop me.
Okay.
So one of the things is that the stormwater management or the permit requires ordinances. So the municipalities are adopting ordinances that do not allow the discharge of anything other than clean stormwater into storm drains. So at least they'll have a way to prevent people from either dumping liquid waste or other kinds of trash or anything like that down storm drains. So that's one kind of regulatory type tool that municipalities will have as a result of their permit.
And can we require local governments to pass ordinances?
Yes, that is one thing we are requiring. That is a requirement of the general stormwater permit, the general small MS4 permit, and so that's one requirement that's written into the permit, and we won't allow any stormwater management plan to be adopted unless it clearly defines what kinds of ordinances they will be adopting to ensure that they don't allow their citizens to discharge anything other than clean stormwater to their storm drains. So that's one thing.
Okay.
As far as a regulatory mechanism that municipalities will have in place. The other thing is, since we've had these discussions about plastics and the stormwater team has been thinking about other ways that we can think about plastics when we're thinking about stormwater management plans. And one of the things is requiring recycling programs or encouraging recycling programs to make sure that plastics are going into recycling bins instead of into trash bins or being thrown onto the ground. So having readily available recycling receptacles so that plastics could go to the right place. So that's one option. The other thing is thinking of plastic or trash as just one of the pollutants of concern. And you might remember from my February stormwater program update at the February meeting when I had those little boxes of our stormwater pollution prevention plan philosophy and how we first think about the pollutants of concern and then the sources and then next the best management practices that address them, and then the measurable goals to ensure that it's working. And then if there still is a pollutant issue, then you go back to the beginning and do it all over again. So if we're thinking of trash or plastics as a pollutant of concern, then we can identify sources. For example, in the city of San Luis Obispo, a source might be farmers market on Thursday nights. So street sweeping after that event, or additional trash pickup. Another BMP would be vectoring out storm drains, and that's one of the things that a lot of our municipalities are proposing, is to a vector truck, if you're not familiar with that, is like a very large vacuum that's on a truck, and it sucks out what is in the drop inlet. So there are lots of different BMPs that municipalities are presenting to us in their stormwater management plans, and so we are ensuring that those things are implemented, and then they'll have a measurable goal for that. And so if they still have trash, even after implementing those BMPs, we'll send them back to the beginning of the process of re-identifying their sources of those things so they can pick better best management practices. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted you to at least maybe not feel that it's slipping underneath the radar screen, but that we are addressing that in the stormwater management plans that we're receiving from municipalities.
Well, I feel better about that. I would like to see that maybe with with that effort, what was the second thing you mentioned?
The regulations?
Recycling?
Well, the recycling. Okay. Well, recycling, you know, there's a state mandate anyway to recycle, 50% diversion. So, I mean, there's some very strong efforts to do that. But I think you're right. We would have to know exactly where trash is actually getting into waterways. Now I just remember what it was. I think it would be good to require, as a BMP, that streets be swept or these waterways be cleaned out before the first flush.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly one of the things that we're looking for in stormwater management plans, is timing. Okay. So even just timing alone is a best management practice. So, for example, in the city of San Luis Obispo at one point, they would first sweep the streets, which happens in the middle of the night, and then next pick up the trash. But if you sweep the streets first and they're very clean, then you pick up the trash, and little bits of trash that don't make it into the truck litter on the streets, the next morning you would still see some trash on the streets. So just by switching the timing from picking up trash first and then sweeping the streets right after, that just timing alone, that was a BMP that reduced trash on the streets. So we're looking at things like that in stormwater management plans. Also, I think you had mentioned that recycling is a requirement, but we're actually finding some of our Attachment 3 MS4s that are not municipalities, but they're state or federal entities that don't have recycling programs. So so we're looking to encourage those.
That's good.
I think this stormwater program, I mean, the ordinance stuff and other things, we should really try and use as much as we can, because the leverage is huge. I mean, there are only a few of us here, you know, the brave and the few. But, you know, we can leverage all these municipalities and all these counties and all these other staff members to essentially be our little foot soldiers out there, you know, doing our will to to do the vision we have.
Very reluctant, I might add, I'm sure.
I'm sure a lot of them. But we have big hammers here.
Well, sort of along those lines, I was wondering, and I don't need an answer for this, but are there other regulations we can require in our permits, such as requiring them to have regulations on low-impact development or pervious surfaces? I mean, while we're asking, you know, requiring them to regulate.
That is another one of the minimum control measures, is that there is something like that. And low-impact development is not specified, but something, it says low-impact development or something like it. So that's one of the things in the post-construction minimum control measure, which is just one of the six. So we are requiring those kinds of things. We'd like to see more low-impact development best management practices, because those are sometimes better than the alternative. Some of the alternatives are things like actually digging up a parking lot and laying pipe underneath the parking lot to store the water, and then building the parking lot right back on top. Of course, you're not getting any actual habitat benefit or anything like that. So we do think that above-ground stormwater treatment through bioswales is a better alternative. And although we can't require that they use low-impact development, we, by putting on workshops to educate the municipalities and the staff, and by having some funding to do some pilot projects, maybe we can start to introduce people to the idea a little bit more, because a lot of municipalities and their staff aren't as familiar with the benefits of low-impact development best management practices as compared to some of the other similar best management practices.
I know we can't require it, but one of the things we might do to make it sort of a natural thing is to help them along in the ways that we want them to go. For example, if we gave them a stack of ordinances for low-impact development and said, you know, well, you can do anything you want, but if you do these, you're done, I think we would find a lot more acceptance. So just make it real easy for them to do what we want them to do. And otherwise, sure, you can go off and spend lots of money and time and do your own thing if you want, but make that, you know, trivial for them to do.
And that's actually exactly what we're hoping to do as part of the conservation ethic with the Santa Maria and the Salinas projects that we're starting to sort of, they're definitely in their infancy, but I've been feeling them out recently to see what kinds of possibilities there are, what kinds of opportunities there are. And one of the things that we'd like to do is to use some funding to help them develop their ordinances that actually implement low-impact development BMPs.
And then those could be model ordinances for the other municipalities?
Exactly, yes. So that other municipalities can use them. It is going to be a legal battle, and I think Mr. Jeffries brought this up, that it's going to be a political, difficult thing when it comes to developers and convincing them to do this sort of thing. But if we can help them out with funding, because that's one of the things that they are reluctant to do, is to spend a lot of their own staff or their legal staff's time defending an ordinance when they could just adopt an easier one to adopt. So we would like to help them by providing them with some funding and some expertise to defend those ordinances. And then once someone has done it, then that can be an example for some of the other municipalities in our region.
And that comes back also to the phasing I talked about before, because as we saw in the Santa Barbara case where someone tried to put in a pervious driveway and had to go through all kinds of enormous stuff. So the first thing to do is simply allow low-impact development. I imagine most municipalities, if you went in and gave them a plan for a low-impact development thing, they'd say, no, we've never done that. You can't do that.
That's very true. A lot of the municipalities' ordinances actually prohibit.
It.
Yeah,
yes.
So that's why we would like to use either Santa Maria or Salinas.
So it'd be nice to have something that requires it, but the intermediate step
exactly.
is, first of all, something that allows it. Second is something that encourages it before you ever get to the you have to.
Right, exactly. So the first thing we need to do is change their ordinances,
yes.
Or help them in changing their ordinances. Then the next thing we need to do is develop a design standards plan that requires it in their municipality for the long term. And then the next thing is to have a pilot project so people can go and see it and feel comfortable with it so that they don't feel like they're doing this design standards plan of something that they don't know works or that they're not familiar with.
Jennifer, why not, you know, instead of calling something low-impact development, why not just pull together the actual criteria that defines it? I mean, so much water has to be held mm-hmm. on-site over such a rainfall amount and not discharged. I mean, isn't that what kind of goes into defining a low-impact development?
Well, and
so much pervious hardscape?
Well, I'll answer your question in sort of two ways.
Yeah.
What you just described is having an actual sort of description, so much water needs to be kept on site. That's in the permit. But they could do it other ways. They can store it in a tank. There's a lot of different ways that they can still meet that requirement. And so, yes, you are dealing with the actual volume issues by storing it in a tank. And you might be dealing with some of the quality issues if sediment has an opportunity to settle out before being discharged eventually. Mm-hmm. But we would like to see specific low-impact development BMPs utilized. And when you talk about low-impact development, they talk about maintaining the sponge. And that's the sponge capacity of a certain plot of land. So, for example, if you had maybe the plot of land that your house is built on, if you imagine what kind of sponge capacity it had before anything was ever built on it, and then you maintain it on that same parcel through things like rain gardens, where you are excavating the soil that's currently there and putting it in much more sandy type soils and things like that so that it can hold a lot more water, and then draining your whole property to that one area. And then that way you get evapotranspiration, filtration. That's an example of a specific low-impact development BMP.
Right, and I'm kind of asking whether
okay.
those kinds of details shouldn't be put into the basin plan. to affect not only new development, where we have maybe more leverage, but there's a lot of everything else is old, and it's there, and still problematic. And so how do we get to it?
I think one of the things we need to do, as I perceive it, most of our stormwater efforts are focused on the quality of the stormwater, leaving the site, the municipality, whatever. But I think we also need to look at the quantity of water, because it alone is an impact. If you're putting more water in that stream than it's ever seen in, you know, 100 years or a millennia, you're going to get erosion in that stream. And that is going to be, you know, sedimentation and all that stuff. That will be a bad situation in and of itself. And that's what impervious surfaces produce, is these big spikes of runoff. That even if it's 100% clean, simply its quantity is going to produce discharge.
Yeah, definitely we agree with that. And especially as we're going to see so much more development, we'll see just unbelievable volumes in municipalities. And so that's what that minimum control measure of post-construction is basically designed to do, is specifically address volume.
And though it's not something we regulate, the flip side is in the winter you're going to have huge, huge spikes. In the summer, everything will dry up because you're not going to get any recharge and base flow of your streams.
If we can require them to keep a certain amount of stormwater on site, why can't we require them to create a certain percentage of sponge, or I don't know how you would put it, and let them figure out how to do it? But so we're not telling them how to do it, but requiring a certain, or maybe 100% of stormwater to go into the ground rather than keep it on site. I mean, I don't know if you could craft it so that it would be legal, but...
Well, I think the L.A. regions have been there already, and they did something like the first 3/4 inches of any storm have to be kept on site.
Well, no, on-site doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah, we don't
actually require it to go into the ground for recharge.
Yeah. That would be even better.
We don't have the jurisdiction to require recharge. We can set performance standards, like you have to maintain X percentage on site in a Baker tank or some other way. So in terms of the basin plan, we can't direct the means of complying with that, either in the basin plan or in a permit. But we can have approved methods that we can encourage and require people to do that or the equivalent. The recharge effect is kind of a side benefit in... Not a side benefit. It's an important benefit of low-impact development that we can't directly require. But
we could, again, make it as easy for them to do the right thing as we can.
Right. And then it also, if we have these kind of pre-approved BMPs, it puts the municipalities and the developers in the position of having to argue that something else is equivalent. And in a lot of cases, I think the traditional ways of doing things are more expensive, so they're in the position of saying, no, I don't want to do this low-impact development. I want to do something else that's less effective and more expensive. And it's easy for us legally to say it's not equivalent.
Okay. What I would appreciate as we see these Phase 2 permits come up, I think in the next 12 months, I'd love to see if you could call to our attention in the staff report or in the permit where you have put some creative thought into how we can address these things. Flag it. Red flag it for us. Okay. Thank you. Well, Bruce, any thoughts on plastics?
Too many thoughts, but I'd like to move it along.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll revisit this somehow. We'll give it some more thought, but...
Daniel Press isn't here, but I received a paper from one of his students a few days ago, and I told Daniel I would distribute that to the board members. It's on this topic of plastics in the ocean. So I'll forward that to you.
All right, so we'll continue the plastics discussion for a later date.
Right, and I mentioned at the outset that as we were working on putting this agenda item together, I was looking forward to the discussion. I think this has been a valuable use of the board's time. I do appreciate the thought that you've put into it and the feedback you've given us.
Good.
And the encouragement.
Good. Well, good job on putting the report together. And let's start to mine our staff's gray matter.
Thank you.
On these issues. Yeah. Okay.